Good morning. Welcome to episode 2 of No Smoke Without Fire. And I'm here today with Debbie Evans, of course. And we're going to get stuck into the subject of the royal family and King Charles in particular, to have a look at some interesting material and to ask some fundamental questions about who he is, what he believes in, and what he's trying to do with our world, because viewers and listeners should be under no doubt that this king is determined to change the whole world into his model. Debbie, welcome. Thank you for joining me.
Hello, Brian. Great to be back. Well, shall we just carry on and now light the fuse yet again and see what we come up with this time?
I think we should start that little fire burning and seeing whether we can get some real interest from our viewers into who exactly our king is and what he's been up to. And I think you're going to kick us off with the Vatican. Is that right?
Well, I was just going to sort of remind people where we left off to segue us into a video that we'll be showing in a minute, before we reset everybody. So let's reset everyone before we start. So yeah, we were looking at religion and how religion has changed, how our perception of the Church of England, Catholicism, Sikhs, Hindus have all become eco. So you've got this word eco in front of them. And these religions that people may think that they are part of, and maybe they're going to church and they're giving their offering in their collection tin. But where's that offering going? Because the money that's going into that offering box isn't going on the church roof. It's not going on local causes. It's going into a central fund. So we were looking very much at the industry, faith as an industry. So we were looking at eco-Sikhs and eco-Hindus, but we didn't look at the Pope. So let's start off today with just looking at King Charles's association with the Pope. And I think we've got an article from the Vatican News there, which says UK ambassador to Holy See foresees excellent relations under King Charles, please note that word, under King Charles III. So I don't know, Brian, but King Charles has been getting around both as Prince Charles and both as King Charles. And of course, we've got the Laudato Si, protect the earth, a dignify humanity, coming straight from the Vatican with Pope Francis' appeal, I ask you in the name of God to defend Mother Earth, Pope Francis.
It is pretty extraordinary, this stuff. We're doing a little bit of a recap here, but remember that initially the role of the king or the queen of this country was to uphold the faith, and that was the Christian faith. And that was actually
Protestant.
That was the Protestant religion. And we've now got to the stage where King Charles is simply saying that he's the defender of the faiths. And one of the things that we got into in episode 1 was, well, hang on a minute, which faiths is he talking about? And he seems to be involved in all of them.
Well, actually, he said defender of faith. So carte blanche. Anything pretty much. And that leads us nicely on to an article that I found in The Conversation, which pretty much asks that question, actually, turning to faiths to shape the planet, how religions shape environmental movement in Indonesia. But this isn't limited to Indonesia. This is turning to faith as a new religion. And another article, of course, that I brought up that I thought was very interesting was James Lovelock. James Lovelock is an environmentalist, and he has said environmentalism has now become a religion. And, you know, I agree. I actually agree. This is the new religion, Mother Earth.
Yeah, Mother Earth, which should particularly get Christians worried about what's going on here. We are turning to worship Mother Earth and making this point pretty strongly. If you're a Christian, you cannot support that. So is this king betraying people? I believe he is in this. I've got to say, I was a little bit worried by that last picture. If we can just bring it back on screen, let me explain. Have a look at this man. And he's wearing a very fine grey sweater there. I'll now bring myself back on screen. We've almost got the same shirts on, so that's going to cause controversy. But I forgot to apologise to the viewers at the start of this that I came straight into the studio from walking the dog, really. So for the first time in a long time, I haven't got a tie on. That's no disrespect to you, Debbie, and others, I don't really mind. Sorry, I digress, but I thought it was worth making a little bit of a joke out of that. But yeah, where are we going? Would it be a good place?
Well, we're going to faith. The whole climate, you know, the whole... And again, look at this next organisation, Faith for Climate. That just says it all, doesn't it? I mean, you know, the fact that we've got an organisation that is all about connecting all of faith for the environment, for the climate, I'd say pretty much says it all. And there's, you know, Brian, there's a lot of money in faith and there's a lot of money in environment and these sustainable goals. And even the World Economic Forum, I mean, everyone has their fingers in the pie. This is just an example from the World Economic Forum. It's the World Bank, it's the United Nations, it's all of them. But this is just an example.
It says as part of its civil society communities, I always love that phrase because that's always coming, bringing you back into George Soros territory, civil society communities. And across our centres, the World Economic Forum engages roughly 125 religious leaders, faith-based organisations, interfaith groups, multi-faith networks, and experts of religion from over 10 of the world's major religions and spiritual traditions. And the forum is going to launch Faith in Action in January 2024. So we're right up to date with this report. And it says that they'll be discussing the impact of religion and spirituality towards public-private cooperation in today's poly-crisis and provide a roadmap for transformative partnerships with business, government, and philanthropic organisations. So there's no messing around there. Would this be a good place to play that little video, the first little video clip we've got? And that might set the scene for people probably quite deeply. Let's have a look.
We have an incredible opportunity to create entirely new sustainable industries, investing in nature as the true engine of our economy.
The current global crisis has disrupted every aspect of our lives, but it has also presented us with an extraordinary opportunity, a chance to reset and accelerate efforts to improve the state of our world.
Changing our current trajectory will require bold and imaginative action, together with determination and decisive leadership. In order to secure our future and to prosper, we need to evolve our economic model, putting people and planet at the heart of global value creation. If there is one critical lesson we have to learn from this crisis, we need to put nature at the heart of how we operate. We are on the verge of catalytic breakthroughs that will alter our view of what is possible and profitable within the framework of a sustainable future. We need nothing short of a paradigm shift, one that inspires action at revolutionary levels and pace. We simply cannot waste any more time. The only limit is our willingness to act. And the time to act is now.
Well, Debbie, I find that video just incredible, not only because there's a wonderful pronunciation of all the things and the problems, but the fact that he's going for global value creation. I found that particularly creepy. So we, who's he talking about? He's talking about global elites, very wealthy people. They are going to change the economic model of the world. And what are they really talking about? Global value creation, i.e. they're going to scoop more money up from the planet. That's what's really going on here.
So they're going to do it fast.
Yeah. I had a little go at imitating the delivery of King Charles, but you might have thought that was actually an audio breakdown. So apologies for that. But yeah, I just don't get a comfortable feeling when this man's talking, because he's not on this planet. He's not in the real world for the average person in UK, never mind in the third world. He has no concept of what it is to live in a country like UK or the US and be short of money and worrying about how you're going to feed yourself in a particular week. So the he's so pompous and the arrogance is breathtaking, but this man is going to change the whole world.
No, he's going to create it. This is what's so interesting, is that he's actually creating a new world. Like he is, I mean, we'll come onto it in a minute, but he seems to be the architect. And perhaps this was why he was a prince in waiting for so long. Because behind the scenes, you know, when the Queen's been taking the spot, when Queen Elizabeth was taking the spotlight and everyone was focusing on the Queen, Charles was always in the background, like the longest heir in waiting. That's all we ever heard. Diana came on the scene. And all the attention was on Diana. But what was Charles doing in these 50 years as heir in waiting? What he was doing, I believe, I mean, I'm throwing it out there for our audience, because this is difficult for many people who are staunch monarchists. But from where I'm sitting, I'm seeing his 50 years as heir in waiting and the attention being taken off him onto the women as allowing him to create this monster, this beast, if you like, into what we're seeing now. And now he's on the throne and he's been crowned. Everything has to happen at pace. So everything's happening very, very quickly. And I agree with you. I think it's extremely dark, but I see him as seeing himself as a creator, not just of Earth and restoring Earth into whatever he wants it for him, for the elite, for the nobility, not for us, not for we are plant life, we're slaves, we're not required, I don't believe, and this is all to create a better world. Sounds a bit like the Michael Jackson song, doesn't it? But this is all to create a better world for them. So I see him as a creator.
Yeah, that's very interesting. While you were describing that, my mind was sort of drifting back to the setup of the Duchy of Cornwall, which is absolutely classic. So hundreds of thousands of acres held by the hectares, actually. I think it's hundreds of thousands of hectares owned by the Duchy, you know, of which he was the key beneficiary, probably still is. But that ruling over Cornwall, which you've described as being a very poor area, comparable to some of the poorest areas in Eastern Europe. So you had a very poor area of UK where he was not only the landowner, but he owned property, he owned all sorts of rights, the fundus going out from the shoreline, all of this he owned. And yet he lived in his privileged houses, living his privileged, wealthy lifestyle with money principally coming in effectively, well, from taxation. I find it obscene.
Yeah, people don't realise when they come to Cornwall for their holidays, when they put money in the car park for the car park just to pay to go on the beach, a percentage of that goes directly to the Duchy. If anybody dies in Cornwall, intestate without a will, their property and their assets automatically go to the Duchy. And I've heard from people that have tried to start businesses, even, you know, eco businesses, wildlife businesses in places like the Scillies, And if it doesn't fit with the duchy and the duchy don't like it, you're kind of almost shunned, almost booted out. So it can be a very dark place. And I've also heard from people that work on duchy land that say, you know, you drive around Cornwall and like everywhere else in the UK, you see loads of potholes in the road. But when the Prince of Wales, as he was then the Prince of Wales, and as we now have Prince William and the Princess of Wales, when they come to visit, apparently the potholes where they're travelling are immediately sort of filled in temporarily for their journey. And then no money comes back into Cornwall. They just take all of the money for their own public engagements. And yet they're the Prince and Princess of Wales. But they take all their money from the Duchy of Cornwall. And likewise, the King, of course, his purse is funded by the Duchy of Lancaster.
Yeah. But I
think one thing too that you were saying there that kind of put an alarm bell in my head, you know, after me saying that he's a creator and then what you were saying about him, think about the towns and the villages that he's created and built, like Poundbury. I mean, perhaps we'll come on about Poundbury on another No Smoke, but he has been the literal architect, not just of the policy, not just of new laws, not just a new way, a reset, but he's also been the physical architect of villages, buildings, all sorts of things. And he's been doing all of this behind the scenes while nobody's really been taking much notice.
Yeah, this is a very interesting point. And I'm going to say here that I've said publicly before, but I'll say it again now. I met the Queen. In person, I met the Queen in the Royal Navy, they had a 40th accession to the throne celebration, which was a dinner on board one of the aircraft carriers. And it was a pretty unique event because every commanding officer, so every officer who was in command of a ship at that time, who could make it to the event, attended, and I was one of the people that went, and there was a dinner. Of course, it was all very well organized, but after dinner there was the opportunity to have a few words with the Queen, so I was able to shake the gloved hand and speak to the Queen. And I found it very, very interesting. I actually asked her a question. I asked her whether she regarded the evening as work or pleasure. And she looked at me and smiled and she said, I regard tonight as pleasure. And I said, why is that? And she said, well, because here I'm amongst friends and I can relax. Now, at the time, I didn't know all the things I know now, but I just took her answer at face value. But it was a very human answer. And I'm going to say, when I shook the gloved hand and I'm speaking to the Queen, I didn't pick up any bad vibes from her at all. I do pick up bad vibes from people, but I didn't pick up any bad vibes from the Queen, whatever that does or does not mean. But I will also say that I've consistently picked up bad vibes from other members of the royal family. And Charles is one, Prince Andrew was another. So a little anecdotal story, but I'm just going to say, yes, this is an interesting concept that he spent ages in the wings, nobody really paying attention to him. Many of people thinking he was a bit of a toff and a little bit of an idiot in some ways. But my goodness, what he's been building. Is that the time
well,
to
actually,
move?
Just to interrupt you just very quickly with my own little anecdotal story, and I'll be very brief because I think so many of the viewers have heard this before, but I'm a sewer flood victim, right? I'm a flood victim. Floods, environment, climate, you know, it's a bit of a concern when people are getting flooded with sewage. I met the then Prince Charles. He came down here and, you know, we flooded the day after the Prince William announced his engagement to Catherine. It was the day after the engagement was announced that we were flooded and we were literally knee-high in sewage. And he came down here and he promised as the Duke of Cornwall, he promised to help us. And this is his area. This is his area of expertise. This is his special interest. Floods, climate, environment. He's not bothered with me. He's not bothered with all of my community that were flooded. He's never been back. We've written to the then Prince of Wales to say you came down, you visited us, you said you'd help us, you've done nothing, nothing, you've ignored us. So, you know, walk the walk, talk the talk. No, he doesn't do either. It's tokenistic. The royal family, they come down to these disasters or natural disasters, as they call them, whatever you want to call them. And it's tokenistic. They're there to shake your hand, say that they care, but they don't, because off they go in their big black cars back to the... I actually wanted to say, if you want to know what life is like living in Cornwall, come and speak to me and I'll introduce you to a load more people that'll tell you what it's like to live in Cornwall and under the control of Cornwall Council. You know, it's very different. So my experience of the then Prince Charles was, at the time, hopeful. I was asleep then. Now, no, he was never going to help us. He's never interested in us. No.
So, Debbie, we can contrast your comment there. Your criticism is very fair criticism. We can contrast it with so we got lack of interest in Cornwall and problems in Cornwall. Let's get into what he really is interested in and which people he does pay attention to. And we're back on the World Economic Forum.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the great reset. Lots of people think it was Klaus Schwab that announced the Great Reset, but actually it wasn't. It was Charles himself. And there you've got the evidence, a golden opportunity, His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales and other leaders on the Forum's Great Reset. And he was the one that announced it prior to Klaus Schwab.
We have a golden opportunity to seize something good from this crisis. Its unprecedented shockwaves may well make people more receptive to big visions of change. A global crisis like pandemics and climate change know no borders and highlight just how interdependent we are as one people sharing one planet. Over the past month or so, despite the ongoing crisis, I've been encouraged to see the growing calls for a green recovery. We need only look to the United Nations Secretary General, to the IMF, the EU, the Petersburg Climate Dialogue, the Canadian government, the COP26 universities network, and business leaders around the world to see this. And as we move from rescue to recovery, therefore, we have a unique but rapidly shrinking window of opportunity to learn lessons and reset ourselves on a more sustainable path. It is an opportunity we have never had before and may never have again. So we must use all the levers we have at our disposal, knowing that each and every one of us has a vital role to play. Everything I have tried to do and urge over the past 50 years has been done with our children and grandchildren in mind. So I can only encourage us all to think big and act now.
There you go. And again, who is we? Our children and our grandchildren. He's talking about the elite's children. This is what just comes to me very strongly when this man speaks. He's not talking about the ordinary hoi polloi out there. He's talking about the elites. And to bring in the International Monetary Fund and global businesses are suddenly turning altruistic and are going to do the best for ordinary families in this country and worldwide is just, well, I could say it's nonsense or it's a pipe dream, but of course this man is dangerous because he's got such immense wealth and power. He is making this stuff happen.
But he's worse than that. I mean, did you hear him? This is rescue and recovery. I mean, rescue, he's playing the rescuer now. It's like he's the, I mean, we'll come on to a bit about the saviour perhaps, but it's like, I'm going to save the world, rescue and recovery, and we're going to do it dramatically now. You know, it's this whole who is he? Who does he think he is? Well, maybe we'll come on to that in a minute. But, you know, people think that, I don't know whether it's people's memories, but do you remember when Hong Kong was handed over to China, for example? I had it in my head, and I asked my mother and my stepfather, actually, who handed Hong Kong to China? And they both said Chris Patten. And then I asked, who was ambassador at the time, and I asked a lot of other people, and they all said the same. But it wasn't, you know, it was Prince Charles. The Queen sent Prince Charles on Britannia, where a lot of business was done between public-private partnership. And it was Prince Charles that handed Hong Kong to China. It was Prince Charles that announced the Great Reset. And do you remember the slogan after, you know, during the pandemic, the Build Back Better, which kind of goes into his recovery, you know, I'm going to be the recoverer. And it was him, it was Charles that coined that phrase, Build Back Better. It wasn't Klaus Schwab, Boris Johnson, or any of the other government leaders or nations leaders. It was Charles back in 2019. And he wrote a letter to Dominica. I tried to highlight a little bit on the right there, Brian, but it was he that coined the phrase back in 2019.
It says, your determination to, quote, build back better, unquote, and make Dominica the world's first climate resilient nation serves as a remarkable example to others. Climate resilient nation, the thought that it's mind-boggling to me, because he demonstrates a mindset which is he's not on this earth, he's in planet Zanussi. But that doesn't mean to say that what he's doing is not dangerous. The more I read and the more I hear,
he actually is. He's not on this earth. He really isn't on this planet, as you're going to find out, you know, shortly.
Yeah. Well, take us on, because you're going to have a look at charities here.
And he's just touching really the tip of the iceberg with the faith and religions. We could go into a whole heap more. But let's look at another nice, juicy funding stream for the sustainable goals, which is charities. And, you know, the royal family are entrenched. They've been embedded into charities for decades, you know, as being patron. And here you get charities founded. This has come from the royal family website. So following His Majesty the King's accession, the below charitable organisations which were funded by His Majesty as the Prince of Wales, you can see that the Prince's Trust is going to become the King's Trust. So all of his charitable work has not disappeared. It's changed. And charity, again, means money, lots and lots of money. And I'm sorry to sound so cynical, but this is where a lot of the funding stream for the sustainable goals and the climate is coming from, charity. And we're now living in the era of giving. It's all about money. And it's not actually just about money. Charities are, you take a bag of clothes down to your local charity shop. Perhaps it's Age Concern, perhaps it's Cancer Research UK. Look who's funding Cancer Research UK. I mean, if you and I, Brian, if we opened a shop in the middle of Plymouth and we said to all the public, can you bring us your stuff that you don't want anymore? By the way, can you come and staff the shop as well for nothing as a volunteer? And what we're going to do is we're going to sell everything off, all your nice donations. We're going to get a nice rich fat profit from it. And we're going to go off and have a holiday. We're going to go off and buy a nice house. We're going to often go off and use it for us. And that's what we're living in now. We're living in the age of giving, where you're not just giving in a tin on the street, or you're not just giving to your local brownie group or to a local jumble sale. You're giving to the Just Giving pages. You're giving to global private partnership charities, quangos, businesses. Yeah. What are they? Are they charities? I don't believe they're charities. They seem more like quangos to me. But there's a lot of money in charity.
Yeah. I don't know what the figure is for UK, but I remember when I was paying a lot of attention to what I call the political charity Common Purpose, which still exists. But I was looking at their funding, and that got me looking into charitable funding in UK. And I think the figure for just the main charities was something about 9 billion. And I'm talking a long time ago with that figure. So it's huge. It is an industry. It's not really charity. It's a charitable industry. And I notice on the King's Fund page there, which we just had on screen, it's saying, and of course, the King's Fund is in all these different countries. It's in Asia, Africa, Caribbean, Europe, and the Middle East. And it goes on to talk about New Zealand, Canada, etc. So this is worldwide stuff that he's set up and involved in. And of course, what accountability is there for these organisations? What accountability does the UK public have, or does the worldwide public have? It's almost nothing, because he's a law unto himself.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you're a charity and you've got somebody like the King or the Prince and Princess of Wales or someone offering to be your patron, the reason that you want them as your patron is because it's going to get you money. It's all about money. But what we've gone from, which is small little grassroots charities that are doing really good work. And, you know, I'm not decrying charity, because there are some amazing grassroots charities that are doing incredible work, but they are relying on tiny donations because they're being drowned out by these massive great, and I can only call them quangos because that's what they are. Most of these charities are also attached to the government. Many of them are funded. They're publicly funded. I mean, my specialist area is autism. The National Autistic Society is funded by the Department of Education. So every taxpayer in the country, whether they like it or not, is effectively donating to the National Autistic Society, who own a lot of property, a lot of assets. And you know, these charities are not what we thought they were. Cancer UK, Cancer Research, for example, is funded by pharma. So King Charles, who's getting money rooting into the sustainable goals, which we'll come into in a minute, rooting money into the sustainable goals, is coming from charities which are being funded by the public twice, through taxation and through donation, and they're being funded by private-public partnerships.
Yeah.
So you can see how big the charity industry is. And the Charity Commission, I mean, maybe that's for another No Smoke, looking at the corruption going on within the Charities Commission. So it's a big industry. It's almost an industrial scale industry, charities.
Yeah, well, it absolutely is. I'm going to say, you're mentioning problems with charities. Perhaps we'll mention a little charity that is doing good work, and that's the Shekinah Mission. And we've been giving them a little bit of help locally by putting in some good quality used items. But I'm very happy to say, yes, of course, there are many very good charities doing things. And we're mentioning one there. So what about A4S and Accounting for Sustainability, where King Charles also got a finger in the pie?
Well, that's his. That is actually, Accounting for Sustainability is King Charles's. He is, oh yeah, he's got his finger in a lot of pies. There you can see, accountants can save the world, celebrating His Majesty the King as a champion of sustainable finance. His private secretary is Sir Michael Peat, a fourth generation accountant. That's the P in KPMG. That's one of the big four, you know, the Deloitte, KPMG, and all of them, Price Waterhouse. So he is an accountant. And as an accountant, what I believe he's been doing is auditing the planet, not just auditing us as his servants, especially the ones in the Commonwealth. We'll come on to that another time. I mean, this subject is huge, but he's been auditing the planet, every leaf, every branch, every flower, every animal, every insect, every twig. He's been auditing. And this is the Sustainable Markets Initiative, which is King Charles's very own initiative. So here you go again. You can see where that is dovetailing into terracotta, which brings us neatly onto terracotta. So the Natural Capital Investment Alliance, which is what this one is, was created by the Prince of Wales through the Sustainable Markets Initiative with Climate Asset Management Lombard ODA. This was all launched in 2021 at the One Planet Summit. Nature, restoring the planet.
In the opening statement of that one, it's talking about 125 trillion annually. Nature's contribution to the global economy is estimated to be worth more than 125 trillion annually. And that might appear to be a sort of innocuous sentence in the first instance. Well, yeah, this is what the value of nature in producing food or trees or whatever the crop is. But actually, what they're doing is an audit to value everything in order that these elites can actually make even more profit off the things that nature is actually giving to mankind for free. The world is largely there to feed mankind and support mankind for free. But every organization that King Charles is playing around with is clearly there to make a profit off what the world provides for free. And this is why I find to suggest that accountants can save the world. What an obscene claim. It's like saying bankers can save the world. Well, what do bankers actually do? Nothing, but apart from manipulate money, the great majority of which has been created out of nothing for their benefit. I mean, when you pull this thing apart bit by bit, we've got a king who is actually talking madness. Is it the madness of King Charles III? Wasn't that a film? I think it was, of a previous regent.
I think it ought to be a film. Yeah. I mean, you know, I look at this whole sustainable accountancy auditing, and I can see in the bigger picture that, from my perspective, what he's done is he's got people to count what's on the planet. He's got a vision of what he wants the planet to be, which doesn't include us, by the way. But he's got a vision of what the planet needs to be. So he's used all this information and these people to give him the information, the data on what he needs to change. So what he needs to create, let's get rid of the old model. So this is what we need to get rid of. We've got too many, we've got too many human beings under over the age of 50, for example. We've got too many disabled people. We've got too many, just think of some vermin. You know, we don't want them. We don't want this particular. They're trying to create a planet for them. Take it back to the World Economic Forum. You will own nothing. You will own nothing. They didn't say we will own nothing, did they? Oh, no. It was all about you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's absolutely hidden in plain sight. I'm curious to see what happens with the audience, you know, what they would be saying, what they will be saying to themselves as they watch and listen to this, and they start thinking about what we're really pulling apart here. But it's vast, but it's very nasty. So we've got a picture of the great man standing next to a very fine tree.
Mike Robinson has taught me well, and so have you, Brian, over the years. Go to original sources. And this is the royal family website. And this is what they're saying about our king with regards to sustainability. So, you know, what we're trying to do is just show people signposts. We're not saying to anybody, you know, trust us, this is what's happening. We're saying, look, this is what we're seeing. It is difficult. It's going to be difficult for a lot of people to swallow any of this. But when you start unpicking it and when you start following the red flags, which is all we're giving you to follow, you start to see the bigger picture, and the sustainability agenda is very much, or it appears to be very much, King Charles's agenda.
Yeah. And you've got another one here, of course, building a, Building a Sustainable Future. And what does it say? For more than five decades, His Majesty King Charles III has been a champion for the fight against climate change and biodiversity loss. Assumption there straight away that climate change is real. He obviously thinks it is, and that's a dangerous starting point. But then it says the Sustainable Markets Initiative was launched by His Majesty King Charles III when he was Prince of Wales in 2020 at the World Economic Forum's annual meeting in Davos. And this is one of your key points, isn't it, Debbie? That it's not that this man is being told to do something or he's getting on board with another agenda. He's actually right there at the forefront, driving stuff. He's acting as a facilitator for all the global corporations and World Economic Forum and any other quasi-political economic group in order to unfold what is essentially the plan for sustainable development in the world under Agenda 2030 by the UN.
Yeah, and what you said there was very, you know, was very evident. You said the five decades, which is the 50 years that we were talking about, where Charles has been heir to the throne. This is this longest heir in waiting thing. But if you go back and maybe on the next No Smoke, we'll look in a little bit more detail at the investiture, because things started to really start. It was almost like he was being groomed between 1969 and 1970. 1969, we've got to remember that Charles is one of the only members of the royal family that's been invested as Prince of Wales. Not all the princes of Wales are invested, like Prince William hasn't been invested as Prince of Wales, but Charles was. And looking back at the investiture and seeing some of the symbology perhaps and some of the ceremonials, then people might get more clues as to what's gone on. But you know, people think that Klaus Schwab is the head of the Great Reset. The Pope is the head of the Roman Catholic Church. However, they all seem or appear to me anyway to report directly to Charles. Everybody seems to be under, as we look in one of the previous slides, everyone seems to be under Charles. So there are many people advising him. There have been many people, in my opinion, grooming him for what we are seeing now. Because since the Queen died and he was crowned, things have been happening very quickly. Wouldn't you agree? They've been happening very quickly. Yeah. I mean, so quickly, it's almost breathtaking. You wake up in the morning and you wonder what is going to hit the headlines next.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And of course, there's haste in the words that come out of his mouth and the World Economic Forum's mouth, Klaus Schwab, wherever you want to go, because they're all now saying time is short. And they're also admitting that their plans in some areas are not work. Their sustainability plans are not up to the point which they'd hoped to get to in 2024. And they're saying, yeah, we've got to push, we've got to accelerate this program. So it's constantly concern from him and others that the plan is not unfolding fast enough and therefore stuff's getting rushed through. Completely agree with that.
But exactly. I mean, there's so much of this, Brian, and I mean, I know that you're looking at the clock and I'm looking at the clock because this is such a big subject, and there's going to be another couple of No Smokes on what we've uncovered and discovered and what we want to share with our audience so that you can go and have a look at it for yourself. But maybe now is timely to stop before we embark on Terra Carta, perhaps, because that's the next segment, if you like. That's where we're leading on to.
Let's give a little sneaky preview of Terra Carta.
Okay, well, let's give a little sneaky preview of Terra Carta. We all remember Magna Carta, right? Everybody's heard of Magna Carta, the rights of the person come above everything else. Not anymore, no. Terra Carta is, well, I tell you what, Brian, if you show up the next slide, I'll let you read out the little preview from the mouth of King Charles on Terra Carta.
He said this as former Prince of Wales, but he said the Terra Carta offers the basis of a recovery plan that puts nature, people and planet at the heart of global value creation, one that will harness the precious, irreplaceable power of nature combined with the transformative innovation and resources of the private sector. And I had to smile a bit as I got to the end, because there we are. Don't worry, those nice profit-making global companies are going to come to the rescue and they're going to look after mankind, not.
No, exactly that. I mean, you know, Terra Carta goes, there's more to say about Terra Carta. It gets more complicated, because where we've reported on Terra Carta, and we'll get onto Astra Carta. So if anybody's shouting at the screen going, don't forget Astra Carta, we haven't forgotten Astra Carta, because he's king of the earth, king of Terra Carta, king of the earth. I'll show you the crests in a while, but he's also king of the universe. But perhaps we'll come onto that in the next segment, because it is completely extraordinary. It's just extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, we've got a little bit of video clip, which we thought we'd share, a little bit of video in a clip we thought we'd share with our audience, which gives us another little insight into King Charles at work. Should we play that and see how we get
Let's.
On? Well, there you have it. I don't know what country that little episode where they were for that. Obviously,
Saudi. It was Saudi,
right? Yeah. So, and I think I'll do a little bit of work to inform myself, but I don't know exactly what the dance regime was about or what the words were that they were singing. But again, we've got him absolutely immersed in another culture. And I'm going to come back to your point that when it comes to the UK and what he's actually doing on the ground in UK, we're just not seeing it.
No, I mean, would you? But I mean, take yourself back. Would you have seen the Queen do that?
No.
Would you? No, is the answer to that. And for everybody that comes to Cornwall, that's what your donations are going to. And when I say donations, they're mandatory, because when you put your money in your car park or when you pay for goods locally, you have to remember that part of that goes to the Duchy of Cornwall, and the Duchy of Cornwall was funding him to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing.
It's our money that's paying for this.
Yeah.
And yet our country is failing.
I'm going to disagree with you on that. Because I've challenged quite a few people on Twitter or X it now is when they say, you know, that the country's failing, the country's falling apart. And I say, no. It's because it's deliberate. The chaos is deliberately created. It's not a sort of accidental, people have changed and they don't know how to do things properly in this country anymore. No, that's not what's happening. What's happening is that we've got people destroying the whole culture and history and morality and infrastructure of this country. That's a planned action, the destruction. And then we are seeing the effects, and people say the country's broken. It is broken, but the important point is that it has been deliberately broken. And then the other bit that came into my head while I saw him bopping with his sword I don't know whether bopping is that. That's probably a little bit.
Is it? No.
It's a bit old, is it?
I understand bopping.
Okay. Bopping is, for us oldies, bopping is probably a bit of disco stuff. Yeah. So there was the great man having a little bit of disco stuff with a couple of swords, as you do. And you said you wouldn't see the Queen doing that. And I knew exactly what you meant, because the one thing about Queen Elizabeth was that everywhere she was, you got a sense of decorum. And yeah, she was aloof, but she had something. He's there bopping on the floor with his swords. But of course, the great downfall of the royal family for me, or these people, the occupancy of our royal family at the moment by this team, that occurred for me with Jeux Sans Frontières, when the royal family got involved in those horrible games that were designed to get people used to the idea that in Europe all the countries were great friends. And so they set up challenges between countries, and there were various games and competitions and points. And you could play a joker. And of course, in one of those editions, the royal family, the youngsters, got involved. So Prince Charles, Prince Andrew were there. Fergie, I think, was involved as well.
Yeah.
And I can remember watching that particular edition with my family, my parents. And my father said, yes, it's amusing, but there's something not quite right about it. And I think he was picking up on the fact that actually the royal family was being made a monkey of by destroying, you know, the status, the appropriate status that they had and the respect from people in this country. So whether they knew what was happening to them or not, I don't know. But for me, yeah, those pan-European games of Jeux Sans Frontières was a big downfall point for this royal family. I got a question before we finish here, Debbie. My question for you is, how do you view the royalty? I mean, are you happy with the concept of nation states and a royal family? Do you feel comfortable with that? But you might say we've got the wrong people in the position at the moment. How do you see it?
Do you know, my family have always been traditional monarchists, and my mother always used to take me to London to see the Queen. And now I see them in a completely different light. So now I'm not a monarchist, but then I'm not a Republican either, because I'm not sure that I'd want a president. You know, I look around in other nations and I think, well, neither of these systems appear to be working, and both seem to end up in tyranny and turmoil and chaos. So the answer, I don't have the answer, and I don't think I can support either camp at the moment. I seem to be politically homeless. I seem to be like, what's going on? Everything's broken down. And when you said, you know, the country's broken down, I agree, but then that was the plan. Build back better. You can't build back better unless you destroy everything first. So that's what they're doing now. Dismantling, destroying everything that we know in order to build back better. But president, royal family, I don't want any of them, to be quite honest. Definitely not the royal family. They're not. We could go back into the, maybe we need Alex Thompson here to go back into the genealogy of the British family and the constitution, because clearly we've been lied to all along. We've been lied to on everything. And the monarchy, I don't believe, is the showpiece that it's meant to be, because a lot of people look at the monarchy and think they're there because they're doing a great job for the UK. Everybody knows the royal family. They bring in a lot of money, a lot of interest, a lot of tourism. I don't see it like that anymore. I see it as the other way around, as they've used us. They've used all of us. They've hoodwinked all of us. They've deceived all of us. They're duplicitous. They don't care for their subjects. Not through my eyes. They have absolute disdain for us. They don't care at all about us. And they've proved it. So For me, I'm afraid I'm not on the royal bandwagon anymore.
No, well, you've been very honest in you know, saying why you think this. My position is that I believe in a nation state that's functioning properly. There's absolutely a place for a monarchy, and I was going to use the word execute, wrong expression where the royalty is concerned, carried out properly. This could give people so much because it's confidence. It could be confidence in the leadership. It's respect. It's an identity. There's a lot of cultural, historic, and constitutional issues which a good royal family could actually work wonders if they were really standing up for their nation state and protecting their people. So my brain says to me, it's not actually a constitutional monarchy problem. It's the lot who have crept into position at the moment. And I think
they're pretenders.
Yeah, I'd agree.
They're not real. They've been put there. They are complete pretenders. They're not there to serve us at all. Yeah. We are there to serve them. As the king at the coronation, he wanted us all to pledge allegiance to him, all of us.
Yeah. Well, okay, that's a good setting to end number two of No Smoke Without Fire. And for the next edition, we'll cover the Terra Carta and the Astra Carta, and then we'll also have a look at the coronation, and we're going to be asking a lot of questions. So we'll end there. Debbie, thanks very much for joining me. Actually, I've enjoyed a relaxed delivery today, so maybe for the next edition I won't be wearing a tie either. We'll see how it goes, but thanks for joining me. It's been great.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.